Again, everyone, hope you're well. We are right slap bang in the middle of the summer, and the boxing action comes thick and fast. We're going to be talking about Artur Beterbiev, that monstrous puncher at light heavyweight, and what next on his immediate horizons. We had Royal Ascot last week, Wimbledon's just around the corner, and all of the big fights seem to be coming thick and fast, including AJ against Usyk, confirmed for August 20th. As Matt Christie, you suggested last week, we had it penciled in. Now you can circle it in the diary.
Yeah. So those of us lucky enough to attend get to go to Saudi Arabia in the blistering heat in the middle of August. That is going to be absolutely glorious, isn't it? I think it's a really, really interesting fight. My initial reaction after the first fight was that I just didn't see how, if it was to be an immediate rematch, how Joshua could make that old boxing cliche, necessary adjustments to win. But the closer it gets and the change to the training team and just how much rides on this really for not only the career of Anthony Joshua, but also his reputation, you do wonder if he will have a little something special in there. And of course, a lot has been going on in the world of Oleksandr Usyk as well, hasn't it? What will his preparation be like? How will he be feeling going into this one? But I think I still am leaning very, very heavily towards Usyk winning the return. But it's a fascinating one.
And interestingly, speaking of the Ukrainian, of Ukraine, we actually have one of their best, Vitaly Klitschko, is going to be on the show this week. Not literally, but we're going to be talking about him and his fight with Lennox Lewis from This Week in History. That was 19 years ago. Yeah, that from 2003. So that's coming up later on the show as well. And as ever, throughout in the background, for particularly, I think, for Joshua, but also a little bit for Usyk, you have the chuntering, mischievous voice of Tyson Fury just constantly, almost like mood music, or just a backdrop, or just a voice very much in your head. Tyson Fury, there's not a day goes by where he can't help himself from saying, even although he's supposed to be retired, that bodybuilder, that jumped up middleweight, this constant sniping about whoever wins, and then he'll come back and sort them out. If this multi-million stroke billion down checkbook seems to exist.
Yes. I mean, Tyson Fury is happy in retirement. Tyson Fury doesn't need the money, but he will come out of retirement if we pay him £500 million. So that's... yeah, read into that what you will. I mean, Tyson Fury, whatever he's doing, is a truly fascinating creature. But I think we have learned over the years to take certain things seriously, take certain things with a pinch of salt, and make sure we give him our full attention when he's in a boxing ring, because for me, that's when he's at his most compelling.
I think there's a quote from Tyson that says, if I do come back... this might have been in the Telegraph Sport. If I do come back, it'll be a sad day for me. It will be that I've let money overcome my morality because I put achievements before money. But he loves mischief more than anything else. And he's been digging away at both AJ and Usyk, sniping away at them for the, what seems like years now, but certainly months. And they will finally settle their differences on August the 20th, despite murmurings that Fury might return, potentially against Joe Joyce in October at Wembley. There you go. Dot, 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 dot. One little news line, Mad. George Kambosos seems to be suggesting that he's going to invoke his rematch clause with Devin Haney, who beat him so comfortably, of course, in just recent weeks. As ever, my views on that, you know, I hate boxers, their promoters, their managers, their TV companies hijacking the sport with these rematch clauses that are already inserted into contract negotiations, which I just think hijacks the sport and it holds up the mechanics of it. But anyway, that's another thing to kind of weave into recent news lines.
I think it is a problem for the sport in that you could have a one-sided fight, which Haney Kambosos was, and then we have a return of it. That isn't particularly enticing at all. And if we're going to be really, really honest, you can make the argument about Usyk Joshua. If that wasn't Anthony Joshua, someone who has got all that hype behind him and is of that status, then I don't think that many people would be that interested in the rematch. Now and again, of course, if you look at the Fury Wilder series, there were certain fights there that demanded a rematch. But as good as the third fight was, the second fight wasn't nearly competitive enough for us to be clamouring for that third fight. The third fight exceeded expectations and then some. But yeah, essentially, it just slows everything down, doesn't it? You've not only got all of the sanctioning body commitments to kind of bog things down, you also now have this relatively new rematch thing coming in, where almost when if a championship changes hands, then we have to see it again in a big fight. So I kind of hope we can get out of that one.
I think the sport's desperate for it. And interestingly, Lennox Lewis against Vitali Klitschko, which is coming up on this week at the end of the show, that was due to be Lennox Lewis Mike Tyson rematch, wasn't it? And Mike Tyson wanted one or two tune-up fights before he went back in with Lennox. That wasn't on the table, so Tyson said, "I'm out." Then it was supposed to be Kirk Johnson, who got injured 2 weeks before, and Vitali, who was supposed to be on the undercard, then got promoted to the main event on just a fortnight's notice. So we'll talk about all of the meanderings and ramblings of that big fight when it comes later on. But there was a rematch clause in that as well, between Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis, from their fight that had taken place, what, a year previously in the 2002. But yeah, I think it's a terrible look for the sport. And whether it's coming from the fighters themselves or more likely from their contract negotiation teams, I think it's something that really needs to change, because the sport is beholden to them and they should be beholden to this great sport. Speaking of great, will we be talking about Arto Beterbiev in that kind of language in the boxing landscape, say in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time. Beterbiev, who's gone 18 out of 18, another knockout, that's 100%, the record maintained, and he just steamrolled his way through Joe Smith Jr. at the weekend. But he did it in two rounds, Matt, and he did it with a bludgeoning surgical precision. You get from Beterbiev a bit of both. You get high-tech technique, and you get thudding power, and Joe Smith Jr. wasn't up to either.
The demolition man, isn't he, Arto Beterbiev? I thought he was brilliant at the weekend. Very, very difficult to fault. And I was, just before, because we record this actually early this week, so we're on a Monday morning, and I was just before we recorded, I was subbing basically the weekend's reports, and I was going through Jack Hershey's ringside report, where he kind of talks about the obvious fight to make now. Really, the only fight to make is against Dmitry Bivol, but he said he wouldn't give Bivol a chance in that fight. And I do think we need to be a bit careful about coming up with these kind of wild predictions at this point. I just think Bivol would not approach that fight like Joe Smith Jr. approached that fight. Joe Smith Jr., as we said last week, was almost made to look Beterbiev. He would make Beterbiev look as good as he possibly could, and that was the case there. There's no way that Bivol would present the opportunities to Beterbiev in the way that Joe Smith Jr. did. I thought Joe Smith Jr., he came out and he was jabbing, and he was jabbing well, but it was clear that Beterbiev was just going to go straight through the middle, and he did so. And those shots through the middle, and the manner in which he patiently took Joe Smith apart, even though it barely lasted 5 minutes, is the mark of a very, very good fighter and a very clever fighter and a hard-hitting fighter. And I think in that form, he does look difficult to beat, but I think it would be a completely different fight if Dmitry Bivol was in the opposite corner.
Yeah, I can't help but agree. And it got me thinking, Matt, about how we should report analyze and praise or otherwise a performance if it's exactly what you expected, or perhaps if the foil, the dance partner in the other corner, made you look as good as you possibly can look. And we said exactly this. We're not after timing. We both said we thought Beterbiev would run through Joe Smith. I mentioned Joe Smith's low left hand. We both said he's too easy to hit. And unfortunately for him, all of that came to bear. What we did see from Beterbiev, though, was we probably saw a bit more movement from him, didn't we, than usual. He was very active on his feet. He was very light on his feet. And as soon as Joe Smith cramped the space, he would just take that step back off to his right. And he was looking for the overhand right hand, Matt, wasn't he, from the first 10 seconds. He knew, like you and I knew, Joe Smith, he's got his hands are low anyway, particularly when he punches, and he tends to have that low left hand. He's just there to be hit. And Beterbiev knew that. But it was great to see the way that he went about it. But he produced the performance that we expected. So where does it sit in terms of how you judge him, how you praise him, how you analyse him? Where's the middle ground between Beterbiev looking monstrous as he did, as Anui did just the other week, and actually just doing what he was supposed to do?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think we also need to be honest about the fact that Joe Smith is one of the best light heavyweights in the world, and Beterbiev just made it look easy. And us saying Joe Smith is one of the best light heavyweights in the world, that is from him operating in and around the very top level in that division, and more often than not having success for several years now. He has, by and large, been a very consistent performer. Okay, he hasn't won every fight. He was widely outscored by Dmitry Bivol, but he did have moments of success during that fight. So for Beterbiev to do that, irrespective of whether it was because Joe Smith's style was made for him or not, the fact that he made it look so easy against a proven world-class fighter is very, very impressive. But I think in terms of Beterbiev's kind of standing in the sport today, has he had the fight to be regarded as one of the best, as one of the top five pound-for-pound fighters? Not yet, through no fault of his own. Will he, if he was to retire tomorrow, would he be regarded as one of the greatest light heavyweights of all time? Not immediately, that's for sure. Not immediately. Might be one of those where we look back on it and go, wow, he was something else. But I think he definitely needs that fight with Bivol. Even though he is the world champion at light heavyweight, he still needs that fight against Bivol, I believe, to kind of take his reputation even higher and even further. Whether that fight will happen, I don't know. It's one of those absolute no-brainer fights that can often be the hardest to make because of the various allegiances that they've got with promoters and networks, etc., etc. But it's one of the best fights to make in the sport. It's almost up there with Terence Crawford, Errol Spence, or Fury versus the winner of Joshua Usyk 2. It's right up there. Is the massive interest in it outside of our little boxing bubble, though? I'm not so sure. I think Jack Hirsch said there was something like about 5,000 people in Madison Square Garden. It was in the Hulu Theatre. There were still tickets available on the day. So Beterbiev, and I don't think Bivol, without someone like a Canelo in the opposite corner, has quite caught the interest just yet. But for us boxing fans that know our boxing and love our boxing and love these best v best matchups, Bivol versus Beterbiev, what a fight. What a fascinating clash of styles, and one that I would find really hard to predict.
Oh, absolutely. It is. I think for the fans, that is, the people who follow the sport, that is a mouth-watering clash. And I would give Bivol a big chance in that fight. But that's a discussion for another day. I mean, just watching the way Beterbiev goes about it, he can be out-jabbed. Particularly, we know Bivol's got one of the best jabs in the game. We also know what we saw against Canelo, his control and mastery of the distance. That is something that would give even Beterbiev something to think about. So Bivol Beterbiev, which would be the champion of Beterbiev against the number one ranked light heavyweight in the world, that would be something to savour. But you're right to mention all that perspective, in terms of what it was that Viterbi have achieved. And I wasn't meaning to be critical in any way. We're just trying to paint some sort of perspective regarding the performance and where that leaves him and what kind of fighter that makes him look like as well. But he did tear through the number two ranked light heavyweight. He was the first man in a dozen years to stop Joe Smith as well, only the second time in his career. And he had him up and down, depending on whether you count three or four knockdowns, one where his knees almost touched the canvas just before the final stoppage. Either way, he was up and down and up and down. It looked like every time Viterbi have hit him, mainly with the roundhouse stroke overhand right, he was hurting him. And then the final kind of stanza, Matt, he was helpless, Joe Smith, wasn't he? In the centre of the ring, he was just about helpless. And Viterbi have just took a couple of steps back and he hit him with two uppercuts, one after the other. And that was pretty much that. So Viterbiev was able to do what he wants. But you're also right to mention it was in the Garden Theatre, wasn't it, down the bottom? It wasn't in the big room at Madison Square Garden. So its kind of position in the sport, perhaps slightly different to its appeal outside of our boxing bubble. And that is something that's important to remember. What we should stress, talking about the possibility of Bivol going forward, which would be a dream fight, was the fact that Anthony Yard, in a wonderfully old-fashioned manner, went ringside to clamour for the fight. Of course, he's right towards the top in the WBO rankings, for which Joe Smith Jr. was the champion, and Viterbiev is now inherited that crown, which means that theoretically, if the rankings were to work, their rankings to work, then Yard would be in line for a fight at some stage. But great to see him ringside, Matt, doing the old school thing, putting his name out there, putting his face out there. He got interviewed live by ESPN on the night as well, to put himself in position to get a shot at the winner. Great old school promotion and PR.
Whatever you think about Anthony Yard's chances against Viterbi, Evan, you know, they're talking about potentially an October Viterbiev versus Anthony Yard fight. Whether you think Anthony Yard has got a chance in that or not, whether you think that you'd rather see Bivol in the ring or not, you have to admire Anthony Yard, who is just actively chasing the best fighter in the division. He's got to say, well, of course I think I can beat him. He's got to say that, hasn't he? And no doubt deep down he does. This is the guy, let's not forget, that was offered a substantial amount of money to step aside and allow Sergey Kovalev just to go straight into a fight with Canelo. But he demanded that he had his shot and he went in there and he fought with incredible guts. He almost got the job done in what would have been a massive upset at that particular point in time. And I think Anthony Yard has learnt from that particular contest. I think he's improved. I don't think he's the number one contender in the division. I think that is something that the WBO are stating. And it would be a huge ask for him to go in there and beat Viterbiev. I think from Viterbiev's point of view, he might find the fact that he now might be ordered to fight Anthony Yard as a little bit frustrating. Here afterwards, he was saying how much he enjoyed the occasion of this one and the fact there was really something. If the fact that there was more belts there, he said it brought out the best in him. So you would think that perhaps an Anthony Yard fight would not get his juices flowing as much as a fight against Dmitry Bivol would. But it's an interesting division. But just before we get to the fights like Anthony Yard and the other guys that are kind of knocking around there, let's just do this one fight so that we know who the best fighter in the division is. And we have to remember, as good as Viterbiev looked, he's 37 years old. This fight with Bivol should be the next one. It should just be.
Well, if it was like working towards a final, as theoretically boxing should be, and then you just get another quarter final, semi final, then a final, then you get another quarter semi final, then a final, and so on, and so you keep fighting the next in line. So you end up with constant sort of semi-finals or finals one after the other, where the champion either wins the trophy and defends it, or someone else wins the trophy and then they defend it. Yeah, absolutely. But that's in our dream scenario. A couple of great lines out of it from Paterbiev at the end, saying, I want to be a good boxer. He was meaning he wanted to show more of his boxing in this fight. And I think we did see that with his footwork and the tactics and technique that he was applying, the way he was definitely looking for specific shots. And he was drawing the leads from Joe Smith, and then he was just taking that. The feet were so quick to get him quickly out of range, and then he was coming back mainly with the right hand. But he said, I want to be a good boxer. My coach, that's Mark Ramsey, my coach says I'm close. At the age of 37, after 18 successive knockouts and several world title defences, after all of that amateur experience, he's getting close to being a good boxer. But you know what they mean, Matt.
You absolutely do. You know exactly what they mean. And I think one of the biggest compliments you can pay him as well is the manner in which Joe Smith Jr. had no chance at all from the start. Smith obviously felt that he had to get his jab going. He had to somehow not allow Paterbiev to get into any kind of rhythm whatsoever. And Joe Smith Jr., as we said last week, he has been watching and studying Paterbiev for years. Joe Smith Jr. is a world-class fighter. Yet a world-class fighter with a good punch, with long reach. I noticed that immediately, a big long reach. And he's been studying this opponent, and he's got all that going for him, yet he was helpless within minutes to this fight. He just, even though he would have thought that he would have known what Paterbiev was going to do, the manner in which Joe Smith reacted to the punches that were coming his way told their own story. He couldn't see them coming. He didn't know what was coming. And that complete and utter discombobulation at the end, in the second round, was a fighter that was just completely helpless and could do nothing to stop the punches that were coming his way. And that, for someone like Paterbiev, who you may look at his record, 18-0, 18 knockouts, and just think he's purely just this come-forward destroyer, it's just not the case. He's just got so much more in his arsenal to draw upon as and when he needs it.
And I said a couple of weeks ago, didn't I? I don't think it might have been with Danny Dignam against Alan Kanouli when we talked about that sort of fight, which was basically over in similar quick fashion in truth. But it's rare when you watch, particularly at world title level, it's rare you watch a fight and you feel deep empathy, if not you feel sorry for one of the fighters in there because you know they're not good enough. And you transform yourself and your mind and imagination into what it is that they might be feeling at the moment. And you just imagine that feeling of helplessness. And I've spoken to people who've talked about that feeling, which is a very rare thing, I think, for fighters. But boxing can be that sphere where you can be so lonely. And it looked that place at the weekend, didn't it? And it reminded me of when I'd been ringside for when Cleverley fought Kovalev, same division, similar kind of setup as well. And I just, for a fighter, when you get in there, when A, you're helpless, but I think B, in the scenario with Cleverley and Kovalev, and it's again the same scenario here with Paterbiev and Joe Smith, where you just can't believe there's another man walking the planet with the power that your opponent has and the ability to do what they've done to you. And I just think that must just be a horrible, horrible thing for any fighter to have to come across. And I think Cleverley faced up to that against Kovalev that night in Cardiff. And I think Joe Smith Jr. went to exactly the same place against Paterbiev at the weekend.
These fighters, they're defined, aren't they, in all aspects of their life, or at least they think they are, you know, by being fighters, and for Joe Smith's point of view, when he's walking tall in and amongst his friends and his family, and he's a WBO champion, he's a world champion in his own eyes, and then you saw it when it was stopped, the fight was stopped. I think he briefly looked as if he was going to protest the stoppage, and then as his cornerman came over and embraced him, and just the look in his eyes of just, first of all, bewilderment. How on earth is that over already? And then it's just that crushing disappointment that he's probably going to have to go back to his family. You know, he was talking in last week's Boxing News about talking to his wife about being one of the best pound-for-pound fighters. All he had to do was beat Beterbiev and he would be one of the best pound-for-pound fighters. And everything just changes in the space of, what, 5 or 6 minutes. It must be a crippling feeling to know that there is someone else that much better than you. And I think if he's honest, I mean, as much as he may now think, right, I wish I could do it all again, I think if he was to look at that fight again, he would just think, I just don't know what else I could do against that man. And that must be so very, very hard to both comprehend and digest.
And it's along the same line. It's one of the reasons why we should always remember as fans. And it slightly disappointed me that, you know, Yard's gone over there. In a sense, he's helping with the promotion, but he's also, you know, operating in this really old school sphere himself by going ringside, taking the trouble out of his weekend to go there, try and drum up the possibility of fight. But when it's talked that it might be Yard in London in October for Beterbiev next, and Yard's pushing that, people's automatic, you go on social media in particular, the automatic reaction is not, this could be a phrase we use, this sort of applicable, but not really applicable, a fun fight. I just can't, it's great for us, the fans, to watch, but fun is going to be the last thing that's going to be in the ring that night if Beterbiev and Yard get together. Be sure about that. Fun fight is kind of how most people would describe that. But instead of saying, and can you imagine, Beterbiev against Yard? I know, and you're right to say, the dream scenario is the champion against the number one, Beterbiev Bivol. Also, it's got clashes in so many ways, stylistically, temperamental. It's just got everything, that fight. So it is the dream scenario. But as a second prize, Beterbiev against Yard. I mean, that's just got three rounds Hagler Hearns written all over it in the light heavyweight division. I mean, that is an absolute barn burner, night crackler of that. That's a hairs on the back of your neck fight, without a question or doubt. But instead of saying that, people's immediate reaction is almost to a man and woman is, Beterbiev is going to smash through Yard. He'll wipe the floor with Yard. It's all of that stuff, which, well, given what we've just talked about with Joe Smith and how his very, the semblance of him as a human being, as a man, as a fighter, everything to his core and his soul has been shaken at the weekend. And there's the potential for that again to happen to, say, someone like Yard against Beterbiev. Why not just sit back for a second and admire the audacity and the courage, the belief and everything else, and then we can talk about who smashes who further down the line. But just sit back and remember we're talking about fighters and men and women here, and think about the big picture and what it is that's going on and what it is that we love and respect about these people and what it is they do and what it is that they bring to the sport, instead of all this wiping the floor with A, B, C and D.
I like that, Alex. I like that. You know, you're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. I don't think people. Well, you can't. We can't. We can't begin to understand the tasks that these brave fighters undertake. And Anthony Yard, after witnessing that, to still want that fight says it all, doesn't it? About Anthony Yard, and the vast majority of top fighters. The vast majority, even when the fights can't be made, it's generally not down to them. It's not down to them not wanting to fight certain fighters. But we do see, particularly with the amount of belts that are on offer, we will see certain fighters aim as low as they can just so they can win a belt. But Yard, throughout, has wanted to prove himself to be the best and will not kind of look for an easy option, and there is not a harder, more difficult option in that division than Beterbiev. At the same time, I understand why people might be disappointed, but you're absolutely right. There's no way that Yard versus Beterbiev, wherever it takes place, is going to be a dud. There's just no way. I just think it's so very difficult to make a case for an Anthony Yard victory that perhaps people would like to see the best in the division fight his best rival, and that isn't Anthony Yard. Anthony Yard versus a Bawatsi, or Anthony Yard versus a Callum Smith on the undercard of Beterbiev Bivol. Wow. Then the winners fight each other after that. Then you've got an absolutely humongous event, haven't you? But it does, unfortunately, it's just not that simple. And I understand completely why it's not that simple. It's not paint by numbers. It's not. But there are certain things that you look at with frustration as fans, and you just go, why can it not just be that simple? Because if you take away all the politics, it is that simple. It should be that easy. But it's not. But no, you're right. Yard versus Beterbiev, if Bivol didn't exist, would be something to get exceptionally excited about.
Do you know what, Matthew? I realise the more we have these conversations each week, I realise you might be on the wrong side of the fence. Maybe I think you're supposed to be a matchmaker. Maybe actually, maybe Frank Warren will have you on his team after all. Maybe that's where you should be.
yeah. I'd imagine Frank Warren is desperate for me to be on his team. Yeah.
Do you know what struck me? It's such a shame, Matt, that Beterbiev is not sort of 9, 8, 7, even 6 years younger. Because when I watch him now, I think about the kind of 2008, 2009, 2010 version of Gennady Golovkin, where He was knocking people out. He just won his title. He was defending it, but he was defending it really against sort of non-high profile names. And he was doing it in relative obscurity. I'm not saying Beterbiev's doing it in obscurity now, but that sort of period in Golovkin's life, you remember when you first started hearing about him, you first started seeing him where he was on a different promotion. He was away from the big lights. He wasn't in America, often fighting in France and Monte Carlo and places like that. And that period in Golovkin's life, so 2008, 16, 8 years, where he had 23 knockouts on the bounce, didn't he, before Danny Jacobs, defending that one of his belts, I think a dozen and a half times or thereabouts. But you know, we particularly remember Golovkin 2010 to 2016, when he started, you know, tearing through opponents that the recognised opponents that we, and I say we domestically in the UK and Ireland, know all about, you know, Macklin, Murray, etc. But that period, probably around about 2008 onwards, where Golovkin was just firing through people but not getting the recognition, and that came later, and it came in time for him. It's such a shame that it's not really quite coming in time for Beterbiev. It might do for one or two fights, but just not quite, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is a shame, and I think it's a really good comparison with Golovkin, in that he was tearing through everybody, and there was an obvious fight for a while, wasn't there, versus Canelo, that was just taking so long to get over the line. Canelo operating at this weird catch weight, even though he was at middleweight. And then all of a sudden, Golovkin starts to look, if not vulnerable, outboxable. Starts to look a little bit his age all of a sudden, again, in that Danny Jacobs fight. And as if by magic, we then get the Canelo fight. So will Beterbiev, by looking sensational against Joe Smith Jr., has he done himself no favours there? Perhaps if he'd laboured over 12 rounds, then we might make the fights that we want might be made. But I wonder if it is kind of, I mean, I don't really want to be negative, because hand on heart, what I have noticed probably over the last 12 months to 18 months is there is a real desire within the sport to make the best fights. And I have started to see that, and we should encourage that, and we should champion that. But also there are fighters like Golovkin that had to go so long in his career before he had what will be regarded as defining fights. Beterbiev also perhaps will have to go through that as well. But it's not even just those two guys. Look at Errol Spence. Look at Terence Crawford. And you can look at other fighters. Even Tyson Fury. And we know Tyson Fury has had the fights with Klitschko and Deontay Wilder. So perhaps it's a bad example. But he hasn't had the fight. And he's approaching his mid-30s. And all these fighters, you suddenly get concerned. And you have to ask questions why. Why are we having to wait until the real stars, the best performers in the whole sport, are getting to their mid-30s and even later before they're let loose in what is regarded as, you know, a best v best matchup. I think it has to be a reflection on the way the sport is governed and the sanctioning bodies and all the different titles and, of course, all the different promoters and broadcasters, which, quite understandably, are pulling in completely different directions.
I think we're lucky in boxing that fighters, just because of their makeup and who they are and what they are, that they still generally want to challenge themselves. I think that the danger is, and this is a difficult one for us to discuss, we've discussed it before, but it's more of a danger and a risk, I think, for the balance of the sport in America than it is over here, because the money over there is so much greater. And that is that there are so many sort of fighters over there who we might not consider premium fighters, who might be world level fighters or thereabouts, but who are getting paid $1.5 million per fight. And it's difficult for you and I to sit here and talk and say that they're not worth that, because we champion fighters and we believe that they're worth as much as they can get. So that's a really difficult discussion for us to have. But I do think that there is the influence of money in America, particularly, detracts from the idea of challenging yourself as a fighter and therefore some of the better fights getting made. But that's not a discussion we're having and leveling at Baterbi ever by any stretch. But the question is time going to be on his side, and will he get any of those career-defining fights? Because this will be one of his most remembered, because he won another belt and he just tore through a guy who you weren't supposed to tear through, and he did it in fine, technical, powerful style. So it's going to be interesting to see whether he gets a Bivol fight or whether he gets any one of Yard. You've got Buatsi, Smith, of course, in behind Callum Johnson. So many Brits in that inside that top 10 in the light heavyweight division. So that is going to take shape. But how Baterbiev's career is going to look ultimately will be determined by what he crams into the final stages of his career. And he is down the stretch at the age of 37. Elsewhere on that card, Robeson Ramirez put in a box-off performance against Abraham Nova. I like the look of Ramirez. I think he's going to... If he goes with the attitude that he has recently, then... Double Olympic champion. He's going to be great to watch because he's very, very aggressive. He brings plenty of attitude, the Cuban, as well. Of course, he had that defeat on his debut, Matt, and he's bounced back from that Lomachenko style. But he does make mistakes. He is hittable. He's very, very aggressive for a southpaw. Think Josh Taylor, and then just think much, much more aggressive. He tries to draw the feints, defend with his head movement, largely a little bit of backward foot movement as well, and then he sort of accelerates with counter punches. Really looking forward to seeing what he can do, but he ultimately produced a spectacular technical knockout of Abraham Nova, who'd been unbeaten so far, and he will hope to push himself close to the top 10 rankings in the featherweight division, one of course which features Lee Wood, Josh Warrington, Maxeo against Navarrete, I think is another potential matchup there in the top two and three. Lara, everyone's forgotten about him, Matt, in that featherweight division as well. And there's a few fights coming up in July. Ray Vargas, who's unbeaten, he beat Gavin McDonald, didn't he, a few years ago. He's in action against Maxeo, and Dogbo against Joe Gonzalez later in July as well. So there's quite a few fights in that featherweight division for which the double Olympic champion, Robeson Ramirez, will be looking to get himself into the mix.
I still haven't seen this fight yet. I was at a wedding over the weekend, so I've caught up on most bits and bobs. But yeah, I still haven't seen this fight, but I have read Jack Hirsch's report. And yeah, he's really impressed with what he sees. And I go back, you mentioned that debut loss. And those of us that know Ramirez from just being this amateur phenomenon, then to lose his debut. And you mentioned Lomachenko. Lomachenko, of course, lost, I think it was his second fight, wasn't it? And it was against Orlando Salido, and a really tough opponent. But Ramirez just kind of just lost a four rounder. And it was massive. It was massive in the box, again, in this little boxing bubble. Nobody else would be aware of it, but in the boxing bubble, that was a jaw-dropping moment. But the manner in which he's rebuilt, I think, is really impressive. And, having seen most of his fights, apart from his most recent one, he looks like he can replicate at least some of that success he had in the amateur ranks. And that featherweight division, with him in it, it's a tremendous division. There's some really good fights to be made.
Yeah, you'll enjoy watching that back. He's really exciting to watch. I'd be interested to see if he carries on with that kind of style going forward. If he does, he'll be in great fights. He'll be trying to knock people out, and he might put himself in danger of getting stopped as well. So that's going to be fascinating to watch. This weekend, there is so much going on. You are well served if you're a boxing fan. In Coventry on Sky on Saturday, Sam Eggington, who's Mr. Entertainment himself, he's in a fight against another unbeaten rival. He beat Bilal Chetu by split decision last year. He's up against an unbeaten Polish fighter this time around at 154 pounds, coming slightly down in weight. Eggington, of course, having been a career welterweight previously. And Zizek, who's the fighter he's up against, moving up in distance and in class for the first time, and away from home, I think, for the first time as well. All of his fights have been in Poland. So he's a kind of unknown. Adam Aziz is going to be on that Sky bill as well, Matt. So there is some coverage on this side of the pond for boxing fans.
I mean, Sam Eggington, I mean, whoever he fights, you want to watch it, don't you? He's like a... Yeah, they squint when you watch him, and it's like watching someone from the 1920s, back when people would get knocked out one week and then they go and flatten someone the week after. And Eggington is that kind of fighter. He's fearless. I mean, the famous story, of course, with Eggington is that he never boxed as a senior at amateur level, lost his job, decided he was going to turn professional just to earn some money, said to John Pegg, look, I want to turn pro, I want to be a journeyman. John Pegg watched him spar, says, there's no way you're going to be a journeyman, pal. But he was the away fighter in his debut, and he won. Sam Eggington won, and I think the way he put it in a recent interview with Boxing News is that some of my plans of being a journeyman went tits up from the start. and he couldn't be a journeyman. He hasn't got it in him just to kind of take a step back, take a breather if he needs to, and allow. He will just go hell for leather in every fight, as we've seen. One of the most astonishing things in boxing is the fact that Sam Eggington is still only 28 years old. You can't quite get your head around it. There was a time, I think, was it 2017, where he looked like he was set for liftoff? I think he'd just beaten Frankie Gavin, Paul Malignaggi. Not saying he was looking unstoppable, but you just thought, wow, he's going to really take some beating. And then it all kind of started to go wrong. I think he lost 3 of 6 fights. But then he came back and he put on that absolute barn burner alongside Ted Cheeseman, nip and tuck all the way, could have gone either way. And since then, Eggington has become something of a headliner over on Channel 5. And that last fight that you talk about, which was our British Fight of the Year last year, was just an astonishing watch. It was a heck of a fight. And the thing is with Sam Eggington as well, okay, we don't know that much about his opponent. I think he's 18-0. As you say, he's had all of his fights in Poland. He has been to the UK on one other occasion as a tourist. He's got friends over here. He promises that he's going to sell a lot of tickets. He looks like a kind of a typically stand-up kind of European fighter from the footage of him I have watched. He looks made for Sam Eggington. But at the same time, Sam Eggington can make the most straightforward jobs very, very difficult indeed. And I'd say that with no disrespect whatsoever for Sam Eggington. I am in awe of that man and that fighter, quite frankly. How he does it, I do not know. But with a Sam Eggington fight, whether you know anything about the opponent or not, you're always thinking, well, if he's a big underdog, he's a live one against Sam Eggington, because Eggington, he can just get drawn into these fights. And his opponent looks durable. He appears to have a good engine. So if he can stand up to Sam Eggington, we could have another war on our hands here. And okay, it's not a marquee fight, but I think it's going to be an appealing one.
And with 6 knockouts in these 18, Zizek, you fancy if he is as durable as Matt says, then this could be a, a long, arduous fight. That's on Sky on Saturday. Adam Aziz is on the undercard. And what, a week or so on from Lauren Price making her debut, Karis Artingstall, Olympic bronze medalist, she makes her debut on the undercard as well. So the kind of building process for Sky continues apace with some of these fresh faces coming in.
Yeah, and what they have done as well, and what they have done in recent events, is that you will see there is a really good trade fight, usually in chief support. And we've got one here, and it's the rematch of a fight that was a very, very violent one last year. River Wilson-Bent versus Tyler Denny. Now, the first one ended exceptionally controversially, where the fight was suddenly stopped. Wilson-Bent had a nasty cut. Tyler Denny thought that it would have been stopped as a consequence of a punch that had landed. Replays proved that it was a left hand that had ripped open the skin of Wilson-Bent. Wilson-Bent claimed foul, but importantly, and unjustly, the referee said, I think, that it had been a clash of heads, and that was the rule, so it went to the cards and it was a draw. Tyler Denny, in the aftermath of that, kind of was threatening to retire because he just felt it was so grossly unfair. I mean, he was looking at replays saying, well, look at that. How even now we've got the evidence in front of us, why is this result being allowed to stand? So they get the rematch, and prior to that moment, it was anyone's fight. I mean, the fact that Wilson-Bent was cut and he couldn't continue, but he wasn't kind of out of the fight at that moment in time. It would have been unfortunate for him if he'd have lost that fight under those circumstances. So I'm really looking forward to this one on that card.
Take your pick. Meanwhile, Saturday, Texas, DAZN. Take your pick. Jess McCaskill back defending her title. She's getting better than ever. Akhmed Aliyev against Ronnie Rios, one of my favourite fighters. I do have a soft spot for Julio Cesar Martinez. He's in that rematch against McWilliams Arroyo. And then probably top on my wish list would be the all top 10 clash at super flyweight between Jesse Bam Bam Rodriguez and Srikaset Sorungvisai, the man who not once but twice beat the great Chocolatito. So, Matt, take your pick.
Oh, exactly the same fight. I mean, Bam Bam Rodriguez looks like a special talent, doesn't he? And you've got Srisaket, who probably has seen better days, but he may have one more little trick up his sleeve. It's kind of the archetypal crossroads fight, isn't it, in a way? And that, for me, that's the fight on this card that I want to see. But it's a really, 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 really solid bill,
isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. It's such a solid bill. I think there's four fights there that you would want to see, and you cannot complain about that. So it's a good card. But if Bam Bam Rodriguez is as good as he's looked, and as good as he's hinted at, and as good as I think he is, I think he could have a bit of a showcase performance here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it, because strictly speaking, even beating Cuadras, which he did in some kind of style, he hurt him, didn't he, in early on in the fight, and then he pretty much dominated most of the action throughout. That was 4 months ago. That was his first fight up at Superfly. That was kind of a coming out performance. But you'd say, you know, somewhat harshly, but I think truthfully, you'd say that Cuadras has been the kind of weak link in the whole super flyweight division that includes Chocolatito, who 5 years ago now, Rungvisai beat not once but twice. Close it was first time, knocked him out, can you believe, the second time. Maybe Chocolatito wasn't quite at his best at that particular period in his life. Estrada, who Rungvisai has both beaten and lost to in narrow, close, competitive fights. So I think you've got to say, like you, I'm with Bam Bam, but it is another jump up in class on the balance of form.
Yeah. No, of course it is. I just think he's going to be ready for that. I don't think we've seen with Srisaket the kind of form that we saw when he was beating Roman Gonzalez. You look back on that now, and they have to be, they have to quite simply be two superb results. After that as well, of course, was when he eked past Juan Francisco Estrada, and that three-fight run was kind of put Srisaket more or less, well, he was. He was in the pound-for-pound rankings. He was regarded as one of the best, but it hasn't quite worked out since then. He's had three since he lost the Francisco Estrada rematch. Sorry, won Francisco Estrada rematch. So he's won three since then, but he hasn't, not against any real sort of opposition. And I just think this might be, I think Rodriguez. And we say Bam Bam. Is he Bam Bam or is he Bam?
I always say Bam Bam.
I like the sound of Bam Bam, but I'm just looking here and I think it might just be Bam. Bam.
So good. We named him twice.
But yeah, I mean, it's a terrific fight. It's a fascinating one. But yeah, as I said, the whole bill is a good one. The whole bill is a good one. Yeah. I mean, I'll be interested as well to see Julio Cesar Martinez, how he looks back down at flyweight after quite a humbling loss last time out. McWilliams Ario, you'd think that he'd have too much for Ario at this point of Ario's career. But again, who knows? Who knows? It's a really good card.
Yeah, that's the one I'm looking forward to next. They fought, of course, last year, and I think, and might be harsh in this, but I think Arroyo was looking for a way out. He had Martinez down. They were both down in the first round, actually, and then Arroyo was down again in the second, and he had I suppose legitimate claims towards the end of that fight But it just looked like he might have been looking for a way out. I think Martinez is just, he's a hard hitter. He's a bit unorthodox. He brings attitude. I think he'll shrug off the Chocolito defeat. He was too big, too good. I think he'll brush that off, and I think he might stop Arroyo in that one. But there could be fireworks. And it's worth mentioning ages with Rodriguez against Srikaset Sorungvisai. The Thai fighter, 35. Chocolatito, 35. Quadras, 33. Even Estrada, the youngest of that quartet at 32, 10 years older than Jesse Rodriguez in his early 20s. Talk about next-gen passing of the torch. Yes, he's coming. He's coming, and he's already here. Looking forward to that this weekend. Coming up next, it's a fight from the ages and a really interesting one too in this week. We take you back to the 21st of June, 2003, the Staples Center, California, which had been a venue for fights between Ken Norton and Muhammad Ali, not title fights, but big heavyweight fights. But this was a rare heavyweight title fight, actually, at the Staples Center. Of course, we'd have another one of those, notably in recent years. But Lennox Lewis against Vitali Klitschko is the fight that we're talking about. Loads of, I think, Matt, when people remember this fight, there's probably certain things that spring to mind. The sort of late notice, inverted commas, the big cut, relative controversy in the finish, tiring, aching heavyweight bodies, particularly Lewis. Just to put us in some sort of perspective about how this one came about.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned initially, there was talk that there was going to be a Mike Tyson rematch, but then there was a fight with Kirk Johnson. Lennox Lewis was going to fight Kirk Johnson, and Vitali Klitschko was going to fight Cedric Boswell on the undercard. Johnson pulled out, and Klitschko was only too happy to step up. And I think it was about 2 weeks beforehand, or it might even been even less. And at the time, I remember thinking, "Wow, Vitali Klitschko is a difficult opponent to prepare for when you're only aware that you're fighting someone like that for that space of time, for 2 weeks. I think even more so now, when you look back on it now, it's insane that they did that, isn't it? After everything that Vitali Klitschko went on to achieve. But of course, at this particular point in time, Klitschko's reputation was nothing like what it went on to be. He, of course, had pulled out, and he was called a quitter for pulling out with an injured shoulder against Chris Bird in a fight that he was winning. Yet he pulled out with an injured shoulder. And I think people were questioning Vitali Klitschko's heart. There were still some question marks about whether he could really take a punch. This was an almighty struggle for Lennox Lewis, and one that many people at the time felt that Vitali Klitschko had kind of been jobbed out of it a little bit. Klitschko started so fast. Boxing News actually said at the end, in their ringside report, this was, by the standards of the world heavyweight champion, a poor performance. There was also some suggestion that Lewis hadn't really taken it seriously. He was half a stone heavier than he had been for when he beat Mike Tyson. Manuel Stewart, who was Lewis's trainer at the time, came back and said, why on earth would we take this fight lightly? I will admit, the Hasim Ratman fight was taken lightly. We didn't do the necessary preparation and we lost as a consequence of that. We've taken this one as seriously as we can. But what they couldn't have accounted for was Vitali Klitschko just being like this almost like Terminator-like presence in the ring. It's an underrated fight for me. It's a firefight. And Lewis doesn't look anywhere near as good as he had done only a few fights before this one. But ultimately now, with the benefit of hindsight and with the benefit of knowing what Klitschko went on to achieve, I think you can make the argument that this is one of Lennox Lewis's most impressive results, particularly that he had to come through some really, really difficult moments early on in the fight to actually get the win. And it's a perfectly legitimate win. The state of Vitali Klitschko's face at the end looks like he's had an argument with a cheese grater. It's horrible. Really, really, really exciting fight.
And the pace of the fight as well throughout is just breathlessly frenetic. I mean, it is unbelievable for a heavyweight fight, the pace that it's fought at. And that, partly because Klitschko just goes at Lennox right from the very start. But if you ever, you know, people think of, they think of Lennox as being this kind of chess-playing thinker, master boxer, heavy right hand, but everything was all behind the jab. Everything was choreographed and orchestrated and well thought out. But actually, this is the performance of Lennox's career where you see the deep, strong underbelly, what it is that makes him tick, what it is that is very much part of his fighting instinct. And Lewis gets through here on heart, will, just about everything else bar his ability, really. And it was a punch that caused the cut. Matt was talking about that in a previous fight. In the third round, Lewis comes out, tries to get on the front foot, tries to push Klitschko back, and he traps him in a neutral corner. It is one big right hand right onto that eye, and it almost peels away in four different segments like an orange or a satsuma, doesn't it? I mean, there are four peeling layers in different directions to that cut above the left eyelid, and that is ultimately what determines the fight. But the pace of it, Matt, and the will to win, the desire of Lennox Lewis, something that I suppose might have been questioned or people didn't quite know about regarding him, that's what comes to the fore in this fight.
And I think you have to give Vitali Klitschko a lot of credit for that. I mean, you mentioned there that everything about Lennox Lewis, everything that made him special, was always coming from that jab. Everything is, if his jab was on form, then Lennox Lewis was very, very difficult to beat, borderline impossible to beat. But Klitschko, by out-jabbing the champion, almost took away Lennox Lewis's biggest advantage or perceived biggest advantage. So Lennox Lewis had to try something else. And there were times where he looked exhausted, even at the end. My perception at the time when I was watching it was that Lennox Lewis was coming on and that he had rode out the storm. Yet when I watched it again today, it was apparent how shattered and exhausted Lennox Lewis was at the end, and how he must have just been so relieved when the fight ended at that particular point in time, because for the first time since the fight started, he could have a proper breather, because it was relentless. The pace was just so relentless. But even through that exhaustion, even though he wasn't being able to do what he wanted to do, that uppercut that he throws in round six that just whacks Klitschko's head back. Of course, Klitschko repositioned his head very quickly and was back moving forward like a horror movie villain. But watching that this morning took me to the Joshua versus Vladimir Klitschko fight, when, of course, Joshua not necessarily rescued the fight, but he confirmed he was back in control when he landed that incredible uppercut against Vladimir Klitschko. And there was a bit of that about that. But what we saw here with Vitaly Klitschko, which we didn't know beforehand, was that Klitschko is just exceptionally, ludicrously durable himself. And I think, you know, when we look back on the perception of Klitschko at this time, it's so different to what it is now. And I don't think that Boxing News would have been, because if you read the report, and I've read the entire thing this morning, it is not remotely complimentary about Lennox Lewis. But if we were writing that now, knowing what we know about Vitaly Klitschko, I think we'd have a different outlook on it.
Yeah, Klitschko would never lose again. He got an unbeaten run of 13 with 10 knockouts from 2003 to 2012, defending the WBC title. There'd be a hiatus, wouldn't there? It'd be 4 years out of the ring from 2004 after the Danny Williams fight. Bravery from Williams that night, you'll recall, when he just was outmatched in every department by the giant Klitschko. And he'd be out of the ring for 4 years, then he'd come in back and he'd revenge his brother's loss. That was something that was a thread throughout his career as well, avenging defeats on behalf of his younger brother, Corey Sanders being one, and then Samuel Peter, his first fight off the break, 4 year break, and he came out and just dominated, didn't he? It just dominated Samuel Peter. And then latterly, a couple of fights that I actually was ringside and commentated on, Matt. Adamek in Poland. That was an amazing experience out in Wrocław, where Klitschko dominated Adamek and ultimately stopped him in 10 rounds. And then I was in Munich the night that he beat Chisora as well. That was a really sort of big night in my career, because that sort of was the night that I ultimately had the tie-up with Box Nation, and then my sort of career took another direction. So, yeah, my own career is kind of tied in a little bit with the latter stages of Vitaly Klitschko's career, which would go on from strength to strength to strength. Amazing to think that Lennox... You sort of think Klitschko had a good career, but it's amazing to think that Lennox was the guy to beat him. How good does that look on a resume?
It looks fantastic, doesn't it? Particularly as it's kind of Lennox Lewis's swan song and I'm off. And I think he won't really admit it, although he kind of does infer it now and again when you get deeper in conversation with Lennox Lewis, is that this was the fight really that made him realise that he couldn't perform at the level that he had been, and he was aware that if he continued to fight, then the deterioration would become clearer and clearer. But yeah, on paper, this looks like a tremendous result. And when you watch it back, it is a tremendous result. It's not like there was a head clash and it was stopped and Lewis's arm. The state of Vitaly Klitschko's face is purely down to the punches that Lennox Lewis was landing. And it is a tremendous result. You talk about kind of Vitaly Klitschko and what he did and the fight. I mean, I was at a Vitaly Klitschko fight. I think I was at a couple. One that sticks in the memory, of course, is Shannon Briggs. Shannon Briggs ended up in hospital after that fight. But Vitaly Klitschko versus Shannon Briggs was not the fight the whole world wanted to see. But you wouldn't know that when you're inside the stadium, because it's just an insane atmosphere. It used to be an insane atmosphere for Vitaly Klitschko fights and Vladimir Klitschko fights out in Germany. And just the build-up, and it's almost like everybody just stopped because the Klitschkos were fighting. And you forget that when you're over here in Britain or you're over in America and people are kind of criticising them for hijacking the heavyweight division. But in the land that they were operating in, they were kings in every sense of the word. Everybody was just desperate to see them. But yeah, he did. He formed, because Samuel Peter didn't beat his brother, but Samuel Peter had made Vladimir Klitschko kind of... Look, he gave Vladimir Klitschko hell, didn't he?
Yeah, he knocked him down several times.
And Klitschko actually won the fight, and that was almost a turning point for Vladimir, wasn't it? Because he had proven that after losing to Sanders, losing to Ross Purity, losing to Lamont Brewster, that he could come through a tough fight, and he did that against Peter. But then Vitaly Klitschko fights Peter and makes it look immeasurably easier. And I remember just being so very impressed with Vitali Klitschko, the way that he looked after so long out of the ring. And he did fight some good guys. We did a Klitschko's Bookazine where we were going through their careers, and they pretty much fought everybody, really, between them. I think the thing that didn't do them any favours in a way, even though it kind of made them as a team, was the fact that they were never going to fight each other. So we went through such a long period where we knew for as long as those two were active and at the top of their game, we were never going to have one man standing tall at the top of the heavyweight division. Because that argument is one that would not even begin, let alone ever be settled. So I don't think that did the kind of Klitschko era any favours, but it was almost a transitional phase between the Lennox Lewis era and where we are now. Interesting era, not loaded with exciting fights, but loaded with very, very dominant performances, which Vitali Klitschko was unleashing immediately after this fight with Lennox Lewis. And as soon as he'd had this fight with Lennox Lewis, it's almost as if that told him as well that he did belong at the very top. And if it wasn't for injuries, I wonder if he'd have been just all the way through for best part of 10 years as the leader. But the fact that he had those injuries because he was supposed to be fighting Hasim Rahman, and he just knew that he couldn't get through the training camp, and he took 4 years out and he came back as good as new. And because he's kind of got that belt with the WBC, what is it? I can't remember what it is. But if he was to come out of retirement tomorrow, according to WBC rules, he would get a shot at Tyson Fury.
Yeah.
I think he's got other things to worry about there.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I think the sort of breaking America, or the idea of breaking America, was I think not quite being able to do that for the Klitschkos. I think mainly Vladimir. I think that's something that's sort of been counted against them in terms of the reputation, particularly on that side of the pond. I think the Sultan Ibrahimov fight is the one that kind of really killed things, wasn't it? Particularly for Vladimir. But to wrap up, and you're right, a couple of points to wrap up, Matt. And until you've been in and around one of those Klitschko events in Germany, till you've done that, I promise you, it is quite difficult to get a handle on how big they were and how perceived they were on that side of Europe. They're amazing events, really well run. After parties and luncheons and all sorts. I mean, they did all of that so well, but they, in Germany, they were kings. And by the way, they were already kind of TV commercial stars, the pair of them in Germany, ahead of this fight. Never mind sort of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years later, where they were still reigning. Even then, they were already TV stars over in Germany before they really enhanced their reputations and Vladimir would come into his own. But speaking of Lennox and weight, I don't think there's any coincidence that a couple of Lennox's worst performances have come when he's been at his heaviest. I mean, Rahman, he was 253. This fight, I think he was 256 and a half. When you think back to the Bruno performance, you look how lithe he was when he fought Bruno. He was 229 when he fought Frank Bruno in 93, 10 years before. And yet you're knocking on for 257 here, a career high when he fought Vitali. And there's no doubt weight and performance factored in Lewis's career down the stretch.
No, absolutely. I mean, he never looked, you know, we say he was out of shape when he fought Rahman in particular. Do you know what? If I'm out of shape, and if I look like Lennox Lewis, I'd be over the flipping moon. if my physique looked like that, crikey, I'd be out of shape all day long. Yes, please. But, there was a suggestion that perhaps he wasn't fighting fit. And when it was put to Emmanuel Steward, look, you know, he's quite heavy, isn't he? And Emmanuel Steward just turned around and he was like, well, look, we were working hard until 7 o'clock last night. Of course he's taking this seriously. But then immediately you think, well, hang on a minute. Why does he need to be training until 7 o'clock the night before the fight? Why do you need to be doing that if you've done everything else that you should have done beforehand? So I think even though the notion that they hadn't taken it seriously was rejected, I think there are a few clues there that perhaps a few shortcuts were taken.
Well, the clues were clearly there for Lennox Lewis, because at the age of 37, having been a world champion for some time, having beaten the biggest names in heavyweight boxing of that period, at whatever stage in their relative careers, and having avenged both of the defeats on his resume, at the age of 37, Lewis decided to walk away from the sport. And I think many people feel that was the right time for him to walk. But it paints perspective. And every sportsman or woman is different about how they age and how their bodies age and how they mature and otherwise. But at the age of 37, Lennox Lewis was walking away from the sport. At the age of 37, it almost feels like Artur Beterbiev is just arriving in the sport of boxing. And we leave you with that on this Glastonbury week, folks. Have a great time. Bye for now.